It's time for security now. Steve Gibson is not here. Well, he is in spirit. He's taking the week off, as I hope you are, too. But we know we didn't want to let you down. So we have put together, for the I think this is the first time Steve's ever let us do this, some of the best clips, the best highlights, the most interesting pieces from the year gone by. Now, without further ado, the best of 2018.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Security Now, episode 695, for Tuesday, Christmas Day, 12/25, 2018. Our best of 2018. Security Now is brought to you by, literally, CashFly. Make this the last month your CDN bill gives you a headache. Join the thousands of others who trust CashFly's reliable network. And just for Security Now listeners, get up to $5,000 in service credits when you sign up by December 31st and migrate in 2019. Learn more at securitynow.cashfly.com. Well, Merry Christmas. Happy New Year, everybody. Leo Laporte here. Steve Gibson has the day off. He has the week off. It's not easy to convince Steve to take the week off, but we're hoping that if he takes some time to himself, he could finish Squirrel, get back to Spin Right 6, and all the things we've been waiting for. Steve, we'd sure like to see those under the tree this year, and maybe 2019 anyway. It was an amazing year for Security Now. I remember when Steve and I first started talking about doing this show 15 years ago. Hard to believe. Steve was concerned there wouldn't be enough security news every week to fill a half hour. Well, the show's grown to 2 hours every week, and there's still not enough time. Man, we had a lot to talk about. One of the number one stories of the year. A story that continues even to this day. The problems Intel's having with speculative execution. Watch. All right, Steve. You have a picture?
So our picture of the week, yes.
It's more
what I was expecting when I said last week that the consequence of being forced to flush the page lookup tables to me was mind-boggling. You know, I'm old school, and I don't really believe any of this works. That can't get off the ground. So, you know, the idea is, as I was explaining last week, the virtual memory mapper in Intel architectures is this three-level lookup table where the address that you're fetching isn't the actual physical address at all. It's an index into a table, which is an index into a table, which is an index into a table. And you need all of those in order to figure out what the value is. And you do cache the result, and those tables are cached. And that's what's called the TLB, the translation look-aside buffer, because there's this notion in general in computing that something you've done recently, you are more likely to do again than not. And the classic example is looping. If you are looping over some code, that means you go back to the top and you do it again with different values or for, you know, different inputs or something. But so that says that, oh, look, I'm rerunning instructions that I recently ran. So this is why the whole concept of caching makes sense. We have dynamic memory, the main motherboard, you know, the whatever it is, 4, 8, 16 gigabytes of main RAM. Due to the technology, it fell behind a long time ago in keeping up with our processors. No one has been able to make main memory go fast. Now, we've talked about little interesting ideas. There's some cross-wire technology that HP's kind of trying to get off the ground. Intel has it too, cross-point. So maybe we'll see something dramatic happen, but so far main memory is compared to the way our processors have just leaped ahead in speed, it's the laggard. So it's necessary to use this notion of reusing something or hoping that you're going to be able to reuse something you recently slowly fetched from main memory again. So all of these modern chips have on-chip caches, and you mentioned L1, L2, L3. They're in a hierarchy. The ones closest to the chip are the fastest and the smallest, and then there's a next level further back, and then a third level, and they each get larger and sometimes slower, but also it's more of a function of access patterns. When you've got multiple cores, now you've got different processor cores all competing with each other for sharing this common pool of cache, all which is trying to provide, like, just a range to feed these hungry chips data as quickly as they need it. So also shared are these virtual memory lookup tables. And so what I was saying last week was, you know, the idea that crossing from the user land, user code, to the kernel would require the flushing of that incredibly valuable, because it's so slow to get it to load it, the idea that it would force the flushing of that cache was just like, you know, as I said, I don't really believe any of this works to start with. I've sort of reluctantly agreed that, okay, Wi-Fi seems to be working somehow at ridiculous speeds, you know, and when modems started going to 56K, it's like, what? No, modems go at 300 baud or maybe 12, but, you know, not 56K, but yeah, they somehow did. So this picture demonstrates what happened on one of three of Epic Games' servers when they installed the Meltdown mitigation. And this is much more in keeping with what I expected. So you can't see it, but there are three chart lines. There's green, orange, and blue, as there's a little index down in the lower left, a little key showing them. And so, and what you see is this sine wave, which anyone who's run a big server is familiar with. That's the diurnal cycle of CPU being busy. You notice it hits a nadir. They're all kind of lowest around 4 a.m., and I'm not sure if this is, you know, UTC or what time zone, but then it also peaks pretty much on the opposite side of the day. And so that's just sort of generally people are sleeping and then they're waking up and doing stuff. Well, that sudden jump is one of the three processors, the green trace, where Meltdown mitigation was applied. And it's about 2.5 times. If you look at the low point there of all the traces, just before 4 a.m., you can see that it crosses right around 10%. And now if you look up at the green line, it's more than 25%. It's like maybe about 27%, whereas the other guys are at 10. So for their use case, the Meltdown mitigation jumped their processor's utilization, CPU utilization, by about 2.7, which I believe, based on the severity of the need to discard this slow-to-acquire cache data every time you switch between the kernel and the user. So this is the kind of picture that is what I was expecting, rather than this, you know, we've heard, 1% or point something or maybe 5. It's like, okay, you know, again, it is completely a function of what you're doing. We've talked
how much kernel mode access you need compared to how much user mode.
Well, actually, it's how much crossing. It's the boundary crossing.
Right. So if you go into the kernel and you read, and then you exit the kernel.
Right.
Then there's that one swap then. But if you go back and forth, that's when you're going to get the biggest hit, right? Because you don't want user mode to have access to kernel mode information. So you flush the cache. You go into user mode, and then you go back to kernel mode. Do they flush it twice? Do they flush it when you go back into the kernel mode? No, you wouldn't need to then.
Correct. You don't need to. Well, you don't need to flush it when you go from the kernel. I mean, when you go from the user to the kernel, because we trust the kernel.
Right.
There's no malware there. It's user code looking at the residual from being in the kernel. And so it's when you switch to the user that the kernel needs to remove its what I described last week as footprints, you know, because essentially and this comes back to that statement I made in any setting where and caching is a perfect example. It's not speculation. We'll talk about that in a second. But in any setting where short-term performance optimizations have global effect, a sufficiently clever task can infer the recent history of other tasks by observing its own performance. In other words, so caching is a short-term performance optimization. And if the cache is global, that is, if everybody gets the benefit of it, then clever tasks can figure out what's in the cache and what isn't by making a fetch and observing how long it takes, observing its own performance. And so the 20,000 view, the 20,000 foot view here is that the way we've been cruising for the last several decades is we've been creating faster performance by creating processors that are increasingly clever about optimizing what they expect to have happen next. But that expectation, whether it's cache or whether it's specular architecture that we'll be talking about, speculation, that inherently allows these kinds of problems. And so that's why this is, as I said before, this is industry shaking. I mean, this has always been sitting there. Nobody really worried about it until now. Everybody's worrying about it. So,
and we don't know who knew about it and when. I mean, we learned about it now, but who knows? Although,
that's true.
It feels like this is, and this is the other thing I've been speculating on. And I can't remember if it was Bruce Schneier or Brian Krebs talked about the synchronicity, the fact that two different teams simultaneously discovered this. I would guess security researchers kind of run down similar avenues.
Four teams, actually.
Wow.
Four teams. Well, if you broaden the window a little bit, within a couple months, and that was Bruce talking about this.
Bruce, okay.
And there is, there is a security community. There's conferences. There's papers being published. Everybody's reading everything.
Right.
And so it's not like there's been no cross-pollination at all. So it may have been, for example, that last summer somebody did something or, like cache timing is that's now a thing.
Well, and Roamhammer maybe, something like
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Yeah, so there's sort of there is something kind of in the air where individual researchers will – kind of think, I'm going to spend some time thinking about this, and because they're often researching in a silo within their own group or their own team or their own university or their own corporation, they're wanting to produce results that are, proprietary until they're publicly disclosed, especially if it's something like this where they have to, whisper what they found to the parties who are affected, then they're not going to be talking about it. So it is interesting, but not surprising that suddenly this just kind of all happened. It was probably set up by, just sort of what was in the air in the last few years and eventually bound to happen. Intel has just reversed its so-called advice to all of its OEMs, saying, stop, 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 stop. patching anybody's firmware. We made a mistake in last week's firmware, and I don't remember if we touched on it last week, but there were it's hard to nail them down. They're saying something as fuzzy as may cause reboot issues or may make your system reboot more often. It's like, wait a minute, more often than never?
More often?
More often than what? You know, in other words, this causes a catastrophic crash of your system. But they don't want to use those words.
Yeah.
So yesterday, the newsroom of Intel sent out, quote, as we start the week, writes in first person, this newsroom
Mr.
persona.
Anonymous, yeah.
I want to provide an update on the reboot issues we reported January 11th. Okay, so that was 12 days ago, but 11 days ago yesterday. We have now identified the root cause for Broadwell and Haswell platforms and made good progress. They're making good progress.
Well.
In developing a solution to address it. Over the weekend, and you can just imagine there's a lot of late nights over there at Intel. Over the weekend, we began rolling out an early version of the updated solution to industry partners for testing. Oh, so everybody was awake. And we will make a final release available once that testing has been completed. Okay, but not now, not yet. Based on this, we are updating our guidance for customers and partners. We recommend that OEMs, cloud service providers, system manufacturers, software vendors, and end users stop deployment
of
current versions.
And those of you who've already installed it, oh, gee, we're sorry.
Oh, and actually that's happening. Dell has announced in following the guidance that they will be offering previous versions of the firmware immediately. Because now Intel has scared everybody that reboots might happen any minute.
So this is but it's Haswell and Broadwell systems. It's not Coffee Lake, KB Lake. It's not the more modern systems. It's older.
It is. They haven't gotten to those yet.
Oh, great.
Oh yeah, it's everything. So it's okay. So they're saying stop deployment of current versions as they may introduce. Get this again. Higher than expected reboots. What? Well, okay. Like, I'm not expecting any. So, I guess a reboot, which is unexpected, well, which you didn't, Control-Alt-Delete, to make happen or pull a plug out or something. Anyway, may reboot. And they say other unpredictable system behavior. Now, by its very nature, unpredictability is something you are working to avoid in your processors. So, yeah. Then they say, for the full list of platforms, see the Intel.com Security Center site, which is very busy lately. Some researchers at a security firm in Tel Aviv named Checkmarks took a look at Tinder's iOS and Android mobile apps and were surprised to find that it lacked HTTPS encryption, if you can believe it or not. Anyone sharing the same Wi-Fi as a Tinder, an iOS or Android mobile Tinder device or Tinder app user can see your Tinder photos, add their own into the photo stream, and track what you do on Tinder. They're not using encryption to keep the photos safe from anybody who wants to eavesdrop. And although apparently they are using encryption for encrypting the actions of a Tinder user, the encryption is spotty, and it turns out that even looking at the encrypted stream, it is possible to ascertain what the user is doing. So Checkmarks produced a proof of concept app called Tinder Drift, which is demoed on YouTube, which reconstructs any Tinder user's online session of what they see and the way they respond to what they see, essentially unmasking any person's behavior who is using Tinder on shared, you know, on a shared Ethernet medium like Wi-Fi. So although, again, this the swipes and matches are encrypted, Checkmarks explained and proved, hackers sharing the same Wi-Fi are able essentially to completely unmask everything that is being done. It turns out that the specific patterns of bytes that represent a left swipe, a right swipe, a super like, whatever that is, and a match are all clear. But even though technically they're encrypted, nobody at Tinder really gave the security of their application much thought, apparently, or any real concern over protecting the privacy of their users. The Verge, in their coverage, asked Tinder to respond to this. And so Tinder did respond, saying that the unencrypted photos are profile pictures, and Tinder is a free global platform, so the pictures are, quote, available to anyone swiping on the app anyway. Of course, what isn't free and global are the individual Tinder users' choices and reactions to those unencrypted, unprotected photos, which this research demonstrates was poorly concealed. So I'm glad, again, we just keep seeing example after example. I mean, we just talked about it with Tavis and Blizzard, and here now Checkmarks in Tel Aviv and Tinder, where we have to have oversight. We have to have an environment where security firms and researchers are able to examine these things. And I'm thankful that they're willing to volunteer their time and do so. You know, they bring some beneficial, positive press to themselves for doing so. And in the process, you know, it's benefiting the users of these applications, for which it's clear not enough attention has been given to security.
Hello, Security Now listeners. I want to tell you a true story on this holiday. A true story of a young podcast network looking for a way to get our shows to you with minimal fuss, minimal expense, minimal trouble. We stumbled upon, I was very lucky actually, a guy named Matt Levine, one of the founders of Cashfly, approached me, I think it was at a podcast expo, said we should be working together. I said, well, tell me about it. Cashfly is a CDN, a content distribution network. And we've been on Cashfly now ever since then, about 10 years, more than 10 years. Not one 3 a.m. phone call, the CDN's down. Not one moment of concern about the bill logging in. You know, have you ever done this? If you have a CDN, and anybody who delivers content to customers, whether it's an app, a podcast, whatever, you probably know this feeling of, gosh, are we going to go over our monthly allocation this month? What are we going to do? Well, we had a really successful show. Lots of people downloading the app. Oh, no. And you're logging into your CDN. Did we go over the cap? Not with Cashfly. They work with you to tailor your plan to your yearly usage trends. It smooths out all the peaks. And on average, customers who switch to Cashfly save 20%. By the way, CashFly, the nicest people in the world. An expert team of smart, easy-to-talk-to, agile techs that can answer all your questions the first time. You will not be put inside a corporate phone tree. No, they care about you. They care about their customers. And they guarantee, get ready for this, 100% availability with their bulletproof 100% SLA. I will vouch for that. Not one. We literally pump petabytes worth of data through CashFly every single month. Every show, when you download a show, audio or video, you get it from CashFly through our CashFly CDN. That means the server is close to you, it's fast, and we haven't lost a single bit. 10 years, a decade, not one bit lost. I love you, CashFly. You will love CashFly, too. CashFly has been building trusted CDN relationships since 2002, since before podcasting. If you don't believe me, listen to Ars Technica. Ars Technica's director of technology. Quote, sometimes we have spike events. Sound familiar? Spikes in traffic generating 15 to 16 million page views. Whoa. With CashFly, you don't see an issue. The CDN just absorbs it. Our customers commend us on that, and I commend CashFly on that. Same experience. A decade without a bit lost, you're going to love CashFly. So here's my invitation to you. Let CashFly give you some sanity back. Their special offer has been extended just for Twit listeners. You go to securitynow.cashfly.com. Okay? That's a special URL. They know then you heard it on Security Now. It helps Steve, helps me. securitynow.cashfly.com. It'll help you too because you will get up to $5,000 in service credits, but you have to sign up by the end of the year, by December 31st, and you have to migrate sometime in 2019. Sign up by the end of the year, migrate by 2019, and up to $5,000 in service credits. And, of course, they'll go through your bill, and they can explain to you why CashFly is better. It's better. That's why. securitynow.cashfly.com. We thank CashFly, as always, for their support. You've heard it at the beginning of every podcast for 10 years. Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. securitynow.cashfly.com. Thank you, CashFly. Oh, back to the show.
Wyoming and New York's governors had both signed some executive orders. And just as we were starting the podcast, news came that the California Senate had passed, I think it was 21 to 12, some similar legislation. The idea being that states have a lot of power over, you know, what happens within their borders. And while even though the major ISPs were lobbying hard to prevent states from going their own way relative to net neutrality, it turns out there are strict limits over what the federal government can do. Because, for example, states have control over their purse, and they can decide how they want to spend their money. So what happened was that we had a bill that passed through California's Senate that is now moving on to the Assembly. And I just checked my notes. It did pass 21 to 12. However, this looks like it's just the beginning. There are also a group of 22 state attorneys general that have gathered together and filed a suit against the FCC. It turns out it's not possible, much as the FCC would like to simply change their own rules. There's laws that govern what the FCC is able to do. And it's necessary for the FCC to demonstrate that conditions have changed sufficiently since an original law was put in place for them to use that to justify subsequent change. And that hasn't happened since the net neutrality law was brought up. It's called the Open Internet Order in 2015. So it turns out that 22 states have joined together in an action against the FCC to challenge the, you know, AGIT PIE's much noticed decision just to toss that 2015 decision out. But more importantly, the EFF, of course, our friends at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, are very much involved in this. They posted a response to California's action, sounding a little annoyed. Apparently, they were involved in the lawmaking, and for whatever reason, I don't know anything about what's going on behind the scenes politically, but the legislation which California has passed so far, they worry would not stand legal challenge. Ernesto Falcon, writing for the EFF, said that there were much stronger things that California lawmakers could have done, and he enumerated three, which are really interesting. So I wanted to share them with our listeners because this gives us a sense for just how much clout states actually do have over what goes on inside their borders. First, Ernesto writes that California spends hundreds of millions of dollars on ISPs, including AT&T, as part of its California Broadband Subsidy Program. He says the state could require that recipients of that funding provide a free and open internet to ensure that taxpayer funds are used to benefit California residents rather than subsidizing a discriminatory network. He writes, this is one of the strongest means the state has to promote network neutrality, and it's missing from this legislation which just passed, which was SB 460. Secondly, he writes, California also has oversight and power over more than 4 million utility poles that ISPs benefit from accessing to deploy their networks. In California, in fact, California is expressly empowered by federal law to regulate access to the poles, and the state legislature can establish network neutrality conditions in exchange for access to the poles. He says, again, that is not in the current bill passed by the Senate. And then third, each city negotiates a franchise with a local cable company, and often the company agrees to a set of conditions in exchange for access to valuable taxpayer-funded rights of way. California's legislature, he says, can directly empower local communities to negotiate with ISPs to require network neutrality in exchange for the benefit of accessing taxpayer-funded infrastructure. He says this is also not included in the California bill. So I thought, I wanted to do some more digging into this because, of course, this has been a big topic of ours and of huge interest. And the voting public has demonstrated overwhelming support for the concept of net neutrality, which, for reasons of the way Washington works with power brokers and lobbying and money, isn't what our government has been doing. But it looks like at the state level, there is very, very strong capability of enforcing this locally. So as I noted at the top, I think we're far from losing this. As a consequence of the nature of this so-called industry of iPhone cracking, we don't have definitive information from Cellebrite, and we're not going to, but all of the evidence suggests that Cellebrite may now be able to unlock from iPhone 5 through iPhone 10. I mean, inclusive, all of them. There was some good coverage in Forbes. Thomas Fox Brewster, writing in his security column for Forbes, he says, in what appears to be a major breakthrough for law enforcement, and again, with caveats that, we don't know absolutely positively for sure, but it's worth just putting it on everyone's radar, and a possible privacy problem for Apple customers, he writes, a major U.S. government contractor claims to have found a way to unlock pretty much every iPhone on the market. Cellebrite, the Israeli-based vendor that's become the U.S. government's company of choice when it comes to unlocking mobile devices, is this month telling customers its engineers currently have the ability to get around the security of devices running iOS 11. That includes the iPhone X, a model that Forbes has learned was successfully raided for data by the Department of Homeland Security back in November 2017, so last November, most likely with Cellebrite technology. He writes, the Israeli firm, a subsidiary of Japan's Sun Corporation, hasn't made any major public announcement about its new iOS capabilities, but Forbes was told by sources who asked to remain anonymous as they weren't authorized to talk on the matter that in the last few months, the company has developed undisclosed techniques to get into iOS 11 and is advertising them to law enforcement and private forensics folk across the globe. Indeed, he writes, the company's literature for its, quote, advanced unlocking and extraction services offering now notes the company can break the security of, quote, Apple iOS devices and operating systems, including iPhone, iPad, iPad Mini, iPad Pro, and iPod Touch running iOS 5 to iOS 11. So then Thomas's column goes into much greater detail, citing interesting but, you know, necessarily hearsay accounts of various models of iPhones being accessed, but as always, you know, without absolute definitive detail. But of course, that's because Cellebrite protects these secrets as much from Apple as it as like from their own customers. You know, they could probably put this in some software. They might be able to package it in something that they sell, but Apple would be first in line to purchase it through a cutout and figure out what Cellebrite is doing, and assuming that they really wanted to, fix the problem. So the way this works is phones must be physically sent to Cellebrite for them to work their magic, and then they either unlock and extract or provide some means subsequently for after the phone is returned, for probably for forensics reasons, to allow the authority that had that device in their possession to then get access to it. So again, this is hearsay and rumor, seems to be pretty well sourced, however. So who knows, you know, what they're doing, what in they may have found. But it does look like if this is to be believed, there may be a way in, given, you know, this sort of extreme access where you have to have, you know, it has to go to Israel in order to be cracked. The picture I have in the show notes is of yesterday's record-breaking attack, showing basically a timeline of prior attacks. One, and I can't quite read, it looks like maybe it's 2001. Can't see it. But anyway, it's 24 gig that it was like, whoa, 24 gig. Oh, what? And then a few years later, 100 gig, Leo. Oh, my God. You know, 100 gig. And then a few years later, 309. Oh, three times more. More than three times more than 100. 309. Few years later, now we're up to about, looks like about 2016, 650 gigs. Okay, you know, wow. Now, yesterday, 1.7. Okay, so I could say it as 1700 gigabits per second or 1.7 terabits per second is where we are. A internet melting DDoS attack. As I mentioned at the top of the show, this is the result of a devastating service being exposed publicly. What's really curious is that this had been noted a couple years ago in some of the Black Hat DEF CON style conferences. It might have been one of the two of those. Someone just sort of noted in passing that, and it may have been that no one thought anyone was crazy enough to have this publicly exposed. But there's a service on Linux platforms called Memcache, or because it's a service, Memcache D for daemon, meaning that it's running in the background. It is a very simple, very fast cache. The idea being that because you might have a very complex SQL database query, after performing a complex, lengthy SQL database query, you might want to do some short-term caching. So it could be in RAM or it could be on the hard drive, depending. But the idea being that you've performed some extensive query, you may need it again. You don't want to go back and reissue the query. So you use this sort of this intermediate cache where you use a key or a tag and the data. So it's very simple. You can't do any fancy queries. You can just say, here's a blob stored under this index. And so this memcache says, okay, and it is accessible over both TCP, and yes, I did say both TCP and UDP. Well, we know what that means if it's publicly exposed. The problem with UDP is there is no provision for verifying the source IP of a query. As we've often discussed with TCP, there is the famous three-way handshake. A SYN for synchronize goes in one direction. A SYN with an ACK acknowledging the receipt of the SYN goes in the other direction. And then finally, an ACK acknowledging the receipt of the second SYN makes the third interchange of the three-way handshake. An interesting side effect is that both endpoints have to tell the truth about their IP addresses in order to receive each other's acknowledgments. Otherwise, it doesn't happen. So TCP cannot be spoofed. UDP is used for lightweight internet traffic where you simply say, give me something. Like, give me an IP address for DNS. And DNS is UDP. And DNS has been used in so-called amplification and reflection attacks. It's amplification because a tiny query can generate a large response. So what that means is that an attacker is able to send little DNS queries to a DNS server, which will respond with much larger replies, thus amplification. But because it's UDP, nothing prevents the instigator of the attack, the person sending the UDP packet, from lying about their IP. They put the IP of the intended victim, the target, in the UDP packet so that the DNS server that receives it believes that guy was asking for a DNS address. And so the larger response goes to the victim of the attack. Thus, the attack is reflected off of the DNS server and amplified, a reflected amplification attack using UDP. Well, there have been a bunch of different types of UDP services exposed and used over time. They all pale in comparison to this one.
Of course, 2018, I hope you're enjoying, by the way. Hello, this best of Security Now. The first time Steve's ever let us do this holiday best of. It's kind of fun to get back and think about all the security nightmares we've suffered through over the year 2018. It was an election year, and of course, everybody was very concerned about election security. Steve had this to say.
For the sake of just not leaving something out that probably doesn't really matter, or I guess it matters because it just demonstrates sort of how nothing is happening like that should. There was what made the news is that the U.S. Department of Homeland Security has designated election systems as a subsector of the country, the U.S.'s critical infrastructure, after the intelligence community broadly concluded last year that Russia had tried to interfere with the 2016 U.S. presidential election. As a consequence, it turns out there's something that I was really never very aware of, that they're called ISACs, I-S-A-Cs, which are is the abbreviation for Information Sharing and Analysis Center, which is our tax dollars here in the U.S. apparently spinning around in circles and getting nothing done.
Oh, man.
Look at this website. I have a link here in the show notes, nationalisacs.org/member-ISACs, I-S-A-C-S. And so there's already a bunch of them. Who knew? And I'll just give you – I'll read down to the I's in alphabetical order. Automotive, aviation, communications, defense industrial base, downstream natural gas – as opposed to upstream natural gas, I guess, electricity, emergency management and response, financial services, healthcare, information technology. Okay. And then that gives you an idea. So who knows what this is? I mean, it's bureaucracy at its finest. And the problem, of course, is that – so the idea is that states and localities are supposed to become members of the – election systems ISAC, and I don't know what happens then. I mean, the problem is, and we've been discussing voting machines for years, which arguably are, based on last year's Black Hat and DEFCON, horrifically insecure. And I mean, we've talked about unauthenticated remote Wi-Fi access, evil made access where there's an active USB port on the side and you can just kind of sally up next to the machine and slip it a thumb drive and take it over remotely and make it reboot and dump its contents out. And we were talking earlier this year about the problem that the Black Hat and DEFCON conference organizers are having for this coming summer's events, because now the people who had traditionally been reselling these machines are being illegally threatened by their machines manufacturers against reselling, with attorneys writing them fraudulent letters claiming that it's illegal to resell them. And you know, this certainly, after what we're approaching the end of year 12 now, and nothing could be more clear to us and our audience than that this whole process is completely bass-ackwards. I mean, completely broken. What there should be is the kind of process that we'll be discussing that adopted and ratified TLS version 1.3, which is a standard that industry and academia together worked on, polished, refined, argued over, fought over, wrestled to the ground, tested, implemented, and just absolutely nailed, and now it is being adopted. That's the process that we should have for something very in many ways sort of similar to that has that shows many similar characteristics to voting automation. The idea that Diebold, pronouncing the name correctly this time, could offer for sale a black box that people adopt and use for something as important as voting, where it's, oh, this is our proprietary technology and you can't see inside, but trust us. No. I mean, and it's insane that this is, you know, that unfortunately this aspect of capitalism has been allowed to take hold and be employed in the U.S. or any, you know, election system. It ought to be an open standard developed in full view. And then, yes, I have no problem if then companies want to compete on implementing the standard which is created, which is what we do now, where we have other standards. No, the standard is open. You implement the standard. It is verified that you have done so correctly, and then you're welcome to sell your hardware that runs the system that has been universally agreed upon and pounded on. You're welcome to sell that. Fine. But, you know, this notion that, oh, you know, we've got the greatest security experts, and after all, we're us. So who cares? Anyway, so nothing is happening. And I don't know how long it's going to take for anything real to happen. But as long as we allow closed architecture voting, which is what this has become, you know, I mean, and this is why now, you know, they're saying, okay, well, let's get a paper trail. Okay, well, okay, I guess that's better, but it still seems problematical. So, you know, this is a problem we know how to solve, but unfortunately, commercial interests in this country are preventing its proper solution. So who knows when that'll change. But however, you know, creating a new bureaucracy to talk about it doesn't seem to me like we're moving in the right direction. Day, April 17th, I guess as a consequence of the fact that April 15th fell on a Sunday, that must be why.
Yeah, and Monday was like Emancipation Day in Washington, D.C., so
that would be Tuesday. Yeah. So, you know, in the U.S., for those who are not in the U.S., our so-called Internal Revenue Service, the IRS, this is our tax filing deadline date for the 2017 calendar year. And one of the headlines I got a kick out of said that the IRS's e-filing system is, wait for it, overtaxed.
That just sounds like a clever headline writer, because what I saw was that the IRS didn't know why it wasn't working.
They don't. Yeah. No.
So I mean, it may not be overtaxed. So it may be something else.
Under attack. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So basically, our U.S. e-filing system, which one would expect to be heavily used, is not been working well all day. And as we know, it is extremely difficult nowadays to keep a system online for which there's any reason for bad guys to want to have not be online. There's so many ways now with DDoS amplification attacks and the ready availability of things that can attack in order to launch these attacks that, I mean, as we've been talking about,
could be some 15-year-old in Columbus, Ohio, right?
Yes. Yes. It doesn't have to be a nation state mounting an attack against the IRS in the U.S. and probably isn't. It's just somebody who says, hey, you know, this is the time that lots of people are going to be trying to be filing their taxes at the e-filing website. So let's just take those guys offline. And if that's the case, I mean, we don't know. But I guess there was some IRS person was giving testimony in front of Congress, and, you know, that's kind of not a big high-profile issue, just some meeting somewhere. And one of the Congress people said, "So, do you know that the e-filing system is offline right now?" And he's like, oh, well, yes, we're looking into that. And we expect it to be back up later today, which apparently they have no idea what's wrong. Oh, and the
it's been 8 hours, at least last time I checked.
And it says that it's a planned outage.
No, and so that's not true.
No, I saw a screenshot.
That seems stupid if you plan an outage on tax filing day.
Wouldn't that be bad planning?
Oh, man, I wouldn't put it past them.
It said April 17th, 2018, planned outage. So which basically means it wasn't planned, but they have the message was planned to appear and declare that it was planned.
Unbelievable.
So, yeah.
The Echo was a breakout product not too long ago. It was the center of Amazon's new voice assistant market. And even at that time, there was a worry that the devices are listening to us. And now we actually know, well, of course they are.
Yeah. So a group named Checkmarks has successfully demonstrated a persistent listening skill for the Echo. As we know, the Echo is extensible. Amazon produces and publishes an API which developers can use in order to create new skills which users can download and add to their Echo in order to do things. What they did was created a proof of concept, which to me seems sort of like, wait a minute, you mean it's vulnerable to that? They created a calculator app, which appears to be a voice-driven calculator. Okay, that's, you know, I guess that's a skill. But when it launches, it spins off a secondary background non-terminating task, which causes any such skill-enhanced Amazon voice assist device, because there's a bunch of different ones, you know, different sizes and shapes now, to indefinitely record all surrounding audio, eavesdropping on users' conversations while also streaming the audio to a third-party server somewhere. So, I mean, it's like everyone's worst fear about what could happen if you have an internet-connected microphone, you know, in your, like, deliberately in your midst, presumably located somewhere, like, that's not in the closet. It's out where everybody, where it can hear everybody, because that's what it's supposed to be doing. They reported the issue to Amazon, and the company has addressed the problem, though not very robustly, in my opinion. In the reporting of this, they said they now regularly scan for malicious skills that, quote, silently prompts or listens for unusual lengths of time, then kicks them out of their official store. And I don't know. To me, for something as important as the security, this feels like an immature and not very well thought out API. No skills, that is, you know, these add-ons, should have any such access, like direct access to the system's microphone. Rather, any skill should register its microphone usage and access policy, whatever that is, and its needs as part of an unhackable signed policy packet, which, you know, Amazon approves, then the developers incorporate into their skill, and then it can't be hacked afterwards. And then the device's API should grant the skills requests, which are filtered through and enforced by the previously declared and approved policy. I mean, it's like this is how you solve that problem. These are not hard things to do. And I'm just sort of I'm surprised that in this day and age, a obviously security conscious company could produce an API that allows a skill to establish a background task which leaves the microphone running and streaming data to the internet. It's like, how do you do that?
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, my understanding was the voice activation part was tied directly to the operating system, and it did submit information to Amazon, but you're right. Why would a skill ever need that? Because a skill is triggered by a voice prompt. It's not as if it's running waiting for the voice prompt.
Right. Right. I just like, okay, let's hope they get this right. And probably, I mean, what they would have to do now would be to re-engineer the API with additional security, maybe taking the lessons that they've learned, because I'm sure they've learned some lessons since its release, and just do a V2 API and over, you know, give developers some time to migrate their skill to the V2, and then just shut down access to the version 1 API that is obviously not secure. I mean, the idea of, we didn't realize that skills could listen persistently and stream audio over the internet, so we're going to periodically scan to see if that's happening. What? No.
We can't keep people out of your home, but we'll drive by every once in a while to see if the lights are on.
Right. See, that's perfect. If everyone's still breathing happily. My Lord.
Now I got an Echo early on, I hook it up every once in a while because there are some projects that I love doing with the Echo. However, one of the very first things that I did when I got one was I set up an AP running through a tap, connected the Echo to that AP. And yep. What concerned me was all the outbound traffic that I saw when I wasn't doing anything.
How noisy it is.
And
yes.
That really, really concerned me. Now, it's gotten better. So obviously they've improved their software. But I'm betting if I were to slap the Echo back on this tap and run one of those skills, I'd be very enthusiastic about the data that I'd be receiving.
Okay. It's being called Glitch, GLITCH. And GL is in caps in the name of this, as in WebGL. A group of researchers at the university in Amsterdam have developed a new startlingly effective remote attack against Android smartphones using the user's web browser and the device's built-in GPU via JavaScript and the WebGL API. So what this means is they have demonstrated that a user of Android visits a particular website. JavaScript is delivered and runs either under Chrome or Firefox. They tested it under both. And get this, in 2 minutes, the attack is so potent that I should mention, this is Rowhammer. Within 2 minutes, their phone is compromised. So it's the first Rowhammer attack to leverage GPUs to leak the computer's memory contents and allow bad guys remotely to compromise a phone. We've been talking about Rowhammer for quite a while. Remember that it leverages a essentially noise in RAM access to cause a bit to flip in the actual memory grid of dynamic RAM as a consequence of it sort of being a malicious access pattern. And it turns out that GPUs are far more effective than CPUs. The reason we haven't seen this on desktops before is that GPUs have their own memory. On lower-end devices like smartphones and tablets, the GPU shares main memory with the CPU. So by leveraging WebGL, which gives the JavaScript extremely accurate timing information, they're able to perform a cache attack with GPU, because the GPU has a much shallower cache than the CPU does, in order to compromise the device within about 2 minutes. So what's not clear is whether there has been some fuzzing in the WebGL support on those browsers. There had been some fuzzing in timing in response to Meltdown and Spectre earlier this year. Under the cert.org page, I went looking to see specifically whether Mozilla and Google with Chrome had responded, and nothing was there. Although in digging around, I saw some reference to perhaps this already having been taken advantage of, but nothing yet posted publicly. So it's not clear. Certainly both companies know, and I'm sure they will be arranging to limit the timing accuracy of WebGL. And essentially that's the crucial thing, as we have been seeing a lot lately, to determine whether for Rowhammer to be used to penetrate caching, is you have to be able to sense whether a particular access was cached or not. And for that, you need to know with very good accuracy what the timing was. So anyway, we do have, again, another instance of our famously often quoted, and I think it was Bruce Schneier who said, attacks never get worse, they only get better.
Ah, trip down memory lane with the Rowhammer attack. Actually, Rowhammer is an interesting story, because once the bad guys figured out that you could do those kinds of timing attacks on hardware, and as you see, even with Android, everybody, there was a field day for all the security research trying to find, the security flaws from timing attacks. And I don't think we've seen the end of that in 2019. I expect many more Rowhammer style attacks. Well, I think we should lighten things up, don't you, a little bit? This is one of the funnier stories of 2018. HTTP error 418. No, really. It's funny. Listen.
We've actually had, Leo, a real-world occurrence of HTTP error 418, I'm a teapot.
How can I do that?
Now,
can I make it happen here?
to remind our listeners, it was April 1st, not surprisingly, of 1998, when RFC, and Leo, you probably want to look this up, RFC 2324. So it's an official IETF.org document, RFC 2324. It is the HTCPCP protocol, which is the Hypertext Coffee Pot Control Protocol. And we're all familiar with the infamous HTTP 404. That's the page not found. You don't normally see the 300s, like a 301 or a 302, because those are the redirects. That's where, and you don't see them because your browser normally does them for you. You click on a link to content that is moved somewhere else, and what you get back is a 301 redirect, which then your browser sees and goes, oh, that content is over at this URL, and you go there instead. Well,
this introduces the brew method. You've got posts, of course, but this is brew.
Yes, and in fact, the RFC begins under rationale and scope. It explains very seriously, there is coffee all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
Increasingly, in a world in which computing is ubiquitous, the computists want to make coffee.
There's also a when method. So when you're adding milk, you can say when.
Oh, it says, coffee brewing is an art, but the distributed intelligence of the web-connected world transcends art. Thus, there is a strong, dark, rich requirement for a protocol designed espressoly for the brewing of coffee. Coffee is brewed using coffee pots. Networked coffee pots require a control protocol if they are to be controlled naturally. So, the hypertext coffee pot control protocol, which you have been exploring, Leo,
yes,
in the RFC
beautifully written
2324 dated April 1st, 1998.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
So what happened? For 7 hours yesterday, many developers using NPM, I'm not kidding, the Node.js package manager.
Yes, I use it all the
JavaScript,
time. Yes, yes.
Were receiving an error message. Error 418, I'm a teapot. The trouble was seen by those teams operating behind a proxy that was appending the port specifier :443 to the domain name on its way across the proxy out onto the public internet.
Well, that's SSL, isn't it? That's
But it was confusing the NPM registry's servers, which resulted in them returning an error 418, I'm a teapot declaration. Yep. Somewhere, someone decided to return that error for unforeseen conditions.
I love it.
And it actually did happen in the real world. So,
so great.
Yes, I'm a teapot lives well past 1998.
That's so awesome.
Adobe Flash cannot die soon enough. What, once again, a actively exploited in the wild zero day had come to life. They announced an emergency patch last Thursday. I don't know. It's like, in other words, you know, when malware, you know, of Flash, you would have to say, when malware has a large reputable publisher. I mean, that's what this is. This is just ridiculous. Okay, so Adobe's own summary for this update said, Adobe has released security updates for Adobe Flash Player for Windows, Mac OS, Linux, and Chrome. Even Chrome's built-in Flash Player was vulnerable. These updates address critical vulnerabilities in Adobe Flash Player 29.0.0.171 and earlier. Successful exploitation could lead to arbitrary code execution in the context of the current user. Adobe is aware, they write, of a report that an exploit for, and then there's a vulnerability for their Flash Player 2018-5002 exists in the wild and is being used in limited targeted attacks against Windows users. These attacks leverage Office documents with embedded malicious Flash Player content distributed via email. In some of the coverage of this, Leo, I saw some observers saying, well, browsers have hardened themselves proactively against Flash, so now the miscreants have figured out another way to leverage the continuing existence of Flash, even though browsers won't use it any longer, but it's still present in people's systems in order to exploit them. And look at this exploitation path. I have the picture here in the show notes. It's like, yikes. The user opens a weaponized Office document which contains a Flash ActiveX embedded object that reaches out to a remote server to obtain a a flash exploit, which is retrieved using public key crypto and then executed, which decrypts itself, and then in step seven uses an exploit in Flash, load or load bytes, to load and trigger the exploit, which then reaches out again to the same server to download shell code, which it's then able to execute on the user's system. So remind me again why it is exactly we're waiting until 2020, the end of 2020 through 2020, to finally be rid of this internet menace called Flash. I mean, you know, we have routers infected, 500,000 routers infected with self-destructing firmware ready to be triggered on word from Moscow. Yet, you know, how difficult could it possibly be for Adobe to push out just one last update to self-destruct all remaining instances of Flash in the wild and make everyone safer? It's just like, my goodness, you know, it's only now being used by websites that still want to use it to display video. Yet we've seen that this slow end of lifing doesn't work on the internet. We've covered multiple instances where Chrome, it's only by refusing to allow things to run any longer that people, and creating well-published deadlines, that people have been forced to move away from technology that, well, you know, it's working, so let's not change anything. Except its presence there is hurting everyone. So anyway, I just had to rant again on this another occasion of a 0 day being exploited of Flash by virtue of the fact that it still exists in people's machines. And what Adobe is going to have to do to be responsible. I mean, I guess we're going to have to wait till the end of 2020, but they need to have it self-destruct. If they're saying we're going to no longer support it, then please, Adobe, kill it. Shoot it in the head. just end of Flash. Goodbye. That's what we need. Cedric Kochan in McAfee's Advanced Threat Research Team came up with a clever hack. And we've seen things like this, Leo, with voice assistants before, where, and I'm sure that there have been some for iOS, where features are added without fully vetting all of the possible ways that they can be abused. Turns out that in Windows 10, Cortana can be abused. Until last Tuesday, this is another of the things that Microsoft locked down. So this one is not a remote problem because it involves Cortana, but a local one. It turns out that if you activate Cortana and she comes alive on a locked machine, so the machine is powered on but locked so that it's not supposed to do anything. Turns out Cortana is still listening. So anyone can come along and activate Cortana. It turns out that you can either phonetically or use the keyboard to start typing. You can type while Cortana is listening for more verbal command. And these guys came up with a multi-stage means, to make a long story short, of running an externally provided PowerShell script from a USB drive that's plugged into the machine That ends up getting registered with a system. Cortana is able to see it. And when you ask for a search, it gets its context, its contents are indexed, which allows you to bring up a file, which in this case is a PowerShell script, which is the first stage of the attack. It's then possible to get that to execute code, your own hacker-provided code, from the USB device and go as far as, for example, completely taking over the locked session and even changing the system's password on a locked machine. The blog posting that McAfee put up was titled, "Want to Break into a Locked Windows 10 Device? Ask Cortana." So that's yet another thing that last Tuesday's patch round fixed, fortunately. And they noted that because they felt that this was, you know, now there's full details published. It takes no advanced hacking ability in order to abuse this. So they were suggesting, and I would absolutely concur, if you do not update, if for whatever reason you have not updated to last Tuesday's patches that fix this, by all means disable Cortana on when the system is locked. And I would argue that's just sound security practice. There are just too many opportunities for this kind of exploit on a system which should just be shut down and not listening to anybody while it's locked. So I would say, even after having patched the June updates, unless you have a compelling need to have Cortana listening while your system is locked, I think it makes a lot of sense to disable that. And had you done so already, this would have never been a vulnerability. I expect there will be some people getting up to some antics with this one, because it's so easy to do. As we know, and this has been in the news a lot recently, increasingly, local police and other law enforcement agencies have been obtaining court orders to compel local cell carriers to disclose the location data of people they suspect of crimes. But significantly, these have not been probable cause search warrants as permitted under the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. They've simply been requests from courts for the business record documents of cellular carriers. And in previous decisions, it's been held that business records are subject to court order and can be obtained by law enforcement for whatever purposes they wish. Okay, so there was a burglar ring operating, I think it was in 2011 they were caught. The ring leader was a guy named Timothy Ivory Carpenter, who was accused of planning these crimes. I guess some of his other cohorts fingered him as the boss, and so he got in trouble. He petitioned, he was first convicted I should explain that the FBI, after they got his name, got a court order to cause the cellular carrier in the region to turn over the records of his cell phone location, which did identify him as being present in the location and time of four of the burglaries. He was found guilty in court, sentenced, and for like a huge number of years, more than several lifetimes, as I recall. He appealed, and the appeal was heard. The appellate court said, nope, we think this is proper, so sorry about that. And it went to the Supreme Court. that the decision of the Supreme Court a day or two ago came down and overturned what the appeals court and the lower courts had said. And this was interesting enough, and I thought would be interesting enough to our listeners, that I've pulled together sort of a summary of this, because I wanted to go over, you know, exactly what this is that was decided. Chief Justice Roberts delivered the opinion of the court, from the document, which I've excerpted from, it reads, "This case presents the question whether the government conducts a search under the Fourth Amendment when it accesses historical cell phone records that provide a comprehensive chronicle of the user's past movements." I'll skip over what we already know from a technology standpoint, but I'll just say that it opens with a clear and perfect, succinct explanation of cell tower location, how the increasing popularity of cellular communications has caused providers to increase the density of towers and thus increases the accuracy of tower-based location, approaching that of GPS, especially in urban areas. And I do have in the show notes at the beginning of this a link to the PDF of the full, it's 158 pages, I think it was, or that might have been in one of the other PDFs. It was like at least 119 of the opinion. Anyway, so here's the summary of the decision. It reads, "Cell phones perform their wide and growing variety of functions by continuously connecting to a set of radio antennas called cell sites. Each time a phone connects to a cell site, it generates a time-stamped record as cell site location information, CSLI. Wireless carriers collect and store this information for their own business purposes. Here, after the FBI identified the cell phone numbers of several robbery suspects, prosecutors were granted court orders to obtain the suspect's cell phone records under the Stored Communications Act. Wireless carriers produced CSLI, that is the cell site location information, for petitioner Timothy Carpenter's phone, and the government was able to obtain 12,898 location points cataloging Carpenter's movements over 127 days, an average of 101 data points per day. Carpenter moved to suppress the data, arguing that the government's seizure of the records without obtaining a warrant, that is to say a search warrant, supported by probable cause, violated the Fourth Amendment. The district court denied the motion, and prosecutors used the records at trial to show that Carpenter's phone was near four of the robbery locations at the time those robberies occurred. Carpenter was convicted. The Sixth Circuit affirmed, holding that Carpenter lacked a reasonable expectation of privacy in the location information collected by the FBI because he had shared that information with his wireless carriers. Cool. So what the Supreme Court held is, one, the government's acquisition of Carpenter's cell site records was a Fourth Amendment search. They say, which is to say, qualifies under Fourth Amendment protection and a search warrant with probable cause needed to be obtained in order for the cell site records to be had. They wrote, "The Fourth Amendment protects not only property interests, but certain expectations of privacy as well." And then they cite a previous case, Katz versus the U.S. "Thus, when an individual, quote, seeks to preserve something as private, unquote, and his expectation of privacy is, quote, one that society is prepared to recognize as reasonable, unquote, official intrusion into that sphere generally qualifies as a search and requires a warrant supported by probable cause. Then they cite a previous case, Smith versus Maryland. The analysis regarding which expectations of privacy are entitled to protection is informed by historical understandings, quote, of what was deemed an unreasonable search and seizure when the Fourth Amendment was adopted, unquote. And again, a previous case, Carroll versus U.S. These founding era understandings continue to inform this court when applying the Fourth Amendment to innovations in surveillance tools. Then they said, next paragraph B, the digital data at issue, which is personal location information maintained by a third party, does not fit neatly under existing precedents, but lies at the intersection of two lines of cases. One set addresses a person's expectation of privacy in his physical location and movements, and then they refer to U.S. versus Jones, where five justices concluded that privacy concerns would be raised by GPS tracking. Then they say the other addresses a person's expectation of privacy in information voluntarily turned over to third parties. Then they cite U.S. versus Miller and also U.S. versus Smith. So this comes back a couple times, these Smith and Miller cases, where expectation of privacy in records of dialed telephone numbers conveyed to a phone company. And those were found not to be protected. That is, there was no expectation in using a telephone dialing numbers. Then they say for the next paragraph, C, tracking a person's past movements through CSLI partakes of many of the qualities of GPS monitoring considered in that Jones case, where it was decided that GPS tracking had privacy concerns. It is detailed so they're saying CSLI partakes of many of the qualities of GPS monitoring. It is detailed, encyclopedic, and effortlessly compiled. At the same time, however, the fact that the individual continuously reveals his location to his wireless carrier implicates the third-party principle of Smith and Miller. Given the unique nature of cell site records, this court declines to extend Smith and Miller to cover them. A majority of the court has already recognized that individuals have a reasonable expectation of privacy in the whole of their physical movements, allowing government access to cell site records, which, quote, hold for many Americans the privacies of life, unquote, and their site Riley versus California contravenes that expectation. In fact, historical cell site records present even greater privacy concerns than the GPS monitoring considered in Jones. They give the government near perfect surveillance and allow it to travel back in time to retrace a person's whereabouts, subject only to the 5-year retention policies of most wireless carriers. The government contends that CSLI data is less precise than GPS information, but it thought the data accurate enough here to highlight it during closing argument in Carpenter's trial. At any rate, the rule the court adopts must take account of more sophisticated systems that are already in use or in development, and the accuracy of CSLI is rapidly approaching GPS-level precision. The government contends that the third-party doctrine governs this case because cell site records, like the records of Smith and Miller, are business records created and maintained by wireless carriers. But there is a world of difference between the limited types of personal information addressed in Smith and Miller, that's the phone dialing, and the exhaustive chronicle of location information casually collected by wireless carriers. The third party doctrine partly stems from the notion that an individual has a reduced expectation in information knowingly shared with another. Smith and Miller, however, did not rely solely on the act of sharing. They also considered the nature of the particular documents sought and limitations on any legitimate expectation of privacy concerning their contents. In mechanically applying the third-party doctrine to this case, the government fails to appreciate the lack of comparable limitations on the revealing nature of CSLI. Nor does the second rationale for the third-party doctrine, which is voluntary exposure, hold up when it comes to CSLI. Cell phone location information is not truly shared, as the term is normally understood. First, cell phones and the services they provide are, quote, such a pervasive and insistent part of daily life, unquote, that carrying one is indispensable to participation in modern society, citing Riley versus the U.S. Second, a cell phone logs a cell site record by dint of its operation without any affirmative act on the user's part beyond powering up. And so they trim this a little bit, saying this decision is narrow. It does not express a view on matters not before the court, does not disturb the application of Smith and Miller or call into question conventional surveillance techniques and tools such as security cameras, does not address other business records that might incidentally reveal location information, and does not consider other collection techniques involving foreign affairs or national security. The government did not obtain a warrant supported by probable cause before acquiring Carpenter's cell site records. It acquired those records pursuant to a court order under the Stored Communications Act, which required the government to show reasonable grounds for believing that the records were relevant and material to an ongoing investigation. That showing falls well short of the probable cause required for a warrant. Consequently, an order issued under 2703, which is what was cited before, is not a permissible mechanism for accessing historical cell site records. Not all orders compelling the production of documents will require a showing of probable cause. A warrant is required only in the rare case, excuse me, where the suspect has a legitimate privacy interest in records held by a third party. And even though the government will generally need a warrant to access CSLI, case-specific exceptions, for example, exigent circumstances, may support a warrantless search, and they provide some citings, reversed and remanded. So, bottom line, and good news for individuals, in my opinion, is that the Supreme Court ruled that the acquisition of CSLI data, that is the entire history of an individual's cell phone movement back through time, as far back as 5 years, can only be acquired by law enforcement if they have probable cause and are able to get a search warrant from a court in order to request the acquisition of those records from the cell carrier. So I think the Supreme Court did us right in this case, and I'm glad that that this will happen. There have been recently an increasing number of instances. I don't think I've talked about it on the podcast, but I've encountered it in reading where law enforcement is just making sweeping requests for cell phone location information without, you know, just asking a court to say, hey, we're able to have this. So from now on, they'll need to show probable cause before getting it. And I think that's probably a good thing.
Hey, if I could interrupt just for a moment. Every year we do this, and we thought this would be a good time of year to do our annual survey, kind of a gift, if you will, to us. If you like what we have done, every once in a while we do these surveys. We try to get to know our audience better. And since you're techies, this one focuses particularly on if and how you might use collaborative software at work. That's what we're trying to find out right now. This is a very short survey, 6 minutes at best, probably a lot faster. I know this is so important to security now, listeners, so I really want to underscore this. We do not collect any personal data for it. We're only looking for a general sense from our audience. So here it is. If you've got a moment, it would be a gift to us. Thank you. twit.to/survey12. Okay, we'll wait a few minutes while you do that. No, we're not going to do that. But when you get a chance, you can do it while you're listening, right? And meanwhile, back to the best of, first time Steve's ever let us do this, the best of Security Now 2018. Happy holidays, everybody, from everybody at the Twit staff. Boy, we have a great crew. They work hard, but we have to give them a little time off on the holidays. So we thought we'd do a Security Now best of, even forcing Steve to take some time off. I bet you he's not. I bet you he's writing the next episode. We do Security Now every Tuesday, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern Time, 21:30 UTC. And I hope you'll come by. We won't be here January 1st. It's New Year's Day, but we will be back January 8th. And I suspect the security flaws will be back as well. But our next segment is something we talked a lot about on all the shows. Kind of a problem. When you wear a fitness tracker, sometimes it's possible to see where you are. There was a big problem at the Pentagon, and then the NSA got into the act. Watch.
Our listeners will recall that I think it was in 2016, we talked about the Strava fitness tracking app, which was just sort of publishing all of the positioning information of its users because everyone kind of thought that would be cool, to look at maps of where people were using their app. Unfortunately, it turned out that there were people on secret military bases going out for a jog around camp who were being logged, and satellite-looking maps had this Strava fitness tracking data overlaid on it, and suddenly there was sort of suspicious, a lot of activity in areas of the desert where nothing was shown on the maps. And so anyway, we talked about it at the time. Well, it turns out that some investigations carried out by reporters from a Dutch newspaper, De Correspondent, and online investigations group Bellingcat have found another instance which caused Polar, the well-known, I think they're Dutch, aren't they?
I
don't remember. Polar is Finnish.
Finnish, yes. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. What they found has caused Polar to suspend its global activity mapping feature. It's kind of not Polar's fault, but well, anyway, so here's what happened. The two groups of reporters discovered that Polar Flow, which is one of Polar's apps, was allowing anyone access to a feature called Explore, which is Polar's activity map. The data exposed on this map included a user's past activity, you know, running, biking routes, and so forth, but included the user's personal details, such as their heart rate, various fitness attributes, and more. What Polar did was they made the mistake of exposing the username and personal details of each individual for each individual activity and route. And it, upon digging into it deeper, it looks like the user needs to explicitly allow that information to be shared, but they probably didn't understand fully the consequences. The reporters tracked down, were able to, thanks to this disclosure, the real-world identities of specific intelligence and military personnel. The journalists used this feature to search the map for the location of known military bases and intelligence agencies' headquarters and training grounds. They were then able to identify the people who reported fitness activity history at those locations. And in several cases, the researchers were able to identify the usernames, which led back to real-world identities, either because the military and intelligence agents used their real names for the Polar app, or because they reused usernames that were associated with them elsewhere, and the reporters were able to make the connections. And also in some cases, the same routes which they ran while jogging on base also contained the jogging and biking routes in other locations for the same person, which then allowed that linkage, exposing what looked like their user's home address. So, again, in response to these revelations, Polar immediately shut down the global activity mapping feature, but they then did seek to clarify that this Polar Flow app does not expose the user's activity and username by default. Polar said that these details are shared only based on an opt-in system, and the data exposed via its activity map had to be willingly shared only by, or had to be and was being shared only by some of its users, with the majority of their users' data remaining private. So I guess I would say that this is clearly a privacy concern, and anybody who is using this really needs to have it be made clear. I mean, there's some tension here, right? Polar, much like Strava, wants to brag about how many people are using their stuff. It's people all over the world. Look at how busy everybody is getting fit and healthy. The flip side is, I mean, it is an information disclosure. And so people, I think, who are saying, you know, yes, I want to, you know, others to be able to see my little red lines where I'm running and or my username and other data, I want to share that, really need to be made aware of the downside consequences from a privacy standpoint.
Yeah, I don't think you can blame Polar Flow for that. I mean, maybe it's good for Polar to show any people use their app, but that's the point of it. Apple's does the same thing with their activity rings. You can share it with other people, and then you compete with them, and so forth.
Do you share it with specific people in the Apple case, though?
Yeah,
because this was shared globally.
Yeah, but
this was a global.
Two things that were wrong. I mean, clearly, if you're an NSA intelligence officer and you're publicly sharing your run route, you need to be kind of go back to school and learn some OPSEC stuff.
That's right.
But there seems to have also been a problem.
You were absent for that day of training when you said
what? but you know, I mean, it's actually not a surprise. There's a lot of military folks in great shape, and so they're exercising. So you know, clearly they're at fault for making it public. The problem really also was there was an API that was exposing this, and they used sequential index numbers for customers, so you could just query the API and get this information. And that's clearly Polar's fault. That's a poor
design from anonymizing standpoint.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, there's lots of apps that, you know, Runkeeper does this too, where you share your run, and people like to do that, and they like to, you know,
so. Yeah.
They probably shouldn't be doing it if they're in a secret location.
Probably not if your location should not be disclosed.
Yeah, especially since this whole thing came up already and, you know.
Exactly. 2 years ago, the memo made the news. And it couldn't have been even any more specific.
It was a running program. It was exactly the same.
Right. So WannaCry.
Oh, man.
Refuses to die.
This is the last year version, too.
Gosh, yeah. So, as we'll remember, WannaCry was the weaponization of a flaw in version 2 of Windows SMB, the server message block, also known as Windows file and printer sharing, that was believed, well, we know that it was leaked by the shadow brokers. We believe it was an internal NSA exploit originally named Eternal Blue. So Eternal Blue was taken and weaponized as WannaCry, which was a very, very destructive crypto malware.
The thing that let it spread over the network, right? That was
the SMB, exactly. Yeah, yeah. It was the propagation mechanism.
Here's my T-shirt.
So,
I'll tell you, you go up to a girl and you say IT Pro TV and chill. If she doesn't say yes, she's not the right woman. I'm just saying. No, all right, okay.
The good news is, with that T-shirt, she can really see you coming. So.
It's a little red.
Yeah.
All right. So, sorry.
It struck again over the weekend. It's expected to shave $250 million from a major Taiwanese semiconductor manufacturer's revenue.
What?
As a consequence of it bringing to a halt multiple semiconductor manufacturing fabrication facilities across Taiwan. The company is the cleverly named Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company.
We just call it TSMC.
TSMC.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not only is it a major supplier of parts for Apple, AMD, NVIDIA, and Qualcomm, but it's Taiwan's largest company. So big guys.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah.
They make the A11 chip for the iPhones and iPads.
Right. Right. And so there was some concern that this would be a supply chain glitch for maybe Apple and others. It's unclear. I mean, it was relatively short. I mean, they were able to get things back up. But they wrote, this virus outbreak occurred due to misoperation during the software installation process for a new tool, which caused a virus to spread once the tool was connected to the company's computer network. So, yeah. So it's taken a chunk out of their revenue, although they're a major company. They're forecasting revenue in the quarter to be around, their original forecast was $8.45 billion. So, it was 8.55, so it's expected to drop by at least 200 billion to 8.45. So anyway, they're saying that the revenue hit could be as high as 256 million, in other words, a quarter billion, but still, you know, they're 8.5 billion, so they'll be okay. What's interesting is it's not clear how this happened, because it didn't just spread, you know, it destroyed their systems. It encrypted their systems. And we'll remember that it was our friend of the podcast, Marcus Hutchins, a.k.a. Malware Tech, who was looking at this immediately upon its appearance on the internet and saw in the code that for some reason this WannaCry malware was checking for, it was making a DNS query. And so, but the DNS domain that it was querying was unregistered. So all of these queries were coming back as no such domain name. So he thought, wonder what that's about. And he registered the domain name. And immediately WannaCry stopped. And so what we surmise is that this was a deliberate kill switch, which was put into the malware by its authors, as a means for them to shut it down if for some reason they wanted to. Well, it's still in place. And as we know, I coined the term internet background radiation to talk about the fact that there are many of these worms, Code Red and NIMDA, still live on some systems, and they're out there pinging around looking for new victims. Similarly, WannaCry is still out looking for other systems to encrypt, but its check for that DNS domain is succeeding, which prevents it from doing so. So we don't know about the details of this Taiwanese manufacturer, TSMC's internal network, but it might be that they've got strict controls over DNS, what DNS queries are allowed to be made to public DNS servers, or they might have some sort of, you know, border protection that's preventing all but some explicitly whitelisted domains. We don't know. But what we do know, based on the information we have, is that if this was WannaCry, it would not have done anything if it had been able to get resolution of that DNS. So maybe it was a variation of WannaCry that has had the kill switch neutered so as not to use it any longer. No one knows, you know, really what happened. But anyway, that's the story, is that this thing, WannaCry, is still, delivering its destructive payload, wherever it can, in at least this instance. The Hacker News reported on some research that the AP, the Associated Press, did, which it's probably, this is maybe a little inflammatory clickbait, but it's worth pointing out to our listeners. The statement was, Google tracks you everywhere, even if you explicitly tell it not to. And there is some truth to it. What the AP found is that preventing Google from acquiring long-term tracking data requires more than turning off the obvious location history function. What the Hacker News wrote was, every time a service like Google Maps wants to use your location, Google asks your permission to allow access to your location if you want to use it for navigating. They say, but a new investigation shows that the company does track you anyway. The AP revealed that many Google services on Android and iPhone devices store records of your location data even when you have paused the location history on your mobile device. Disabling location history in the privacy settings of Google applications should prevent, it is argued, Google from keeping track of your every movement, as its own support page states, quote, you can turn off location history at any time. With location history off, the places you go are no longer stored. That's not true. As the AP explains, quote from the AP, for example, Google stores a snapshot of where you are when you merely open its Maps app. Automatic daily weather updates on Android phones pinpoint roughly where you are. And some searches that have nothing to do with location, like chocolate chip cookies and kids' science kits, pinpoint your precise latitude and longitude, they write, accurate to the square foot, and save it to your Google account. During their coverage, to demonstrate the threat of this, what they consider, I mean, again, clickbait, but worth understanding, of this Google practice, the AP created a visual map of the movements of a Princeton postdoctoral researcher, Dr. Acar, who carried an Android smartphone with location history switched off to prevent location data collection. However, the researcher discovered that the map includes records of Dr. Acar's train commute on two trips to New York and visits to Highline Park Chelsea Market, Hell's Kitchen, Central Park, and Harlem. To protect the privacy of Dr. Acard, the publication did not plot the most telling and frequent marker on the map, his home address. According to the researchers, this privacy issue affects around 2 billion Android users and hundreds of millions of iPhone users across the world who rely on Google Maps or search. In response to the AP's investigation, Google issued the following statement, quote, "There are a number of different ways that Google may use location to improve people's experience, including location history, web and app activity, and through device-level location services. They say we provide clear descriptions of these tools and robust controls so people can turn them on or off and delete their histories at any time." Jonathan Mayer, whom we've spoken of years past, often a Princeton researcher and former chief technologist for the FCC's Enforcement Bureau, argued, "If you're going to allow users to turn off something called location history, then all the places where you maintain location history should be turned off." He says that seems like a pretty straightforward position to have. So, for what it's worth, to stop Google from saving time-stamped location markers, users need to turn off another setting, and that's that web and app activity, which is enabled by default and stores a variety of information from Google apps and sites to your Google account. Once disabled, it will not only stop Google from storing location markers, but also prevents the company from storing information generated by searches and other activities. So anyway, if I just wanted to point this out, it seemed a little over the top in the way it was being described, but it's certainly reasonable if somebody wasn't really paying attention and thought that just turning off location history shut that down completely. You also need to go into your Google account and turn off web and app activity, which does not just record activity, but where that activity occurred.
Hope you're enjoying our best of security now. We're taking a couple of weeks off, as I mentioned. We'll be back January 8th. I bet you that Steve is not playing Fortnite right now, but a lot of you are. I mean, really, isn't it a Fortnite Christmas? except on Android, where Fortnite turns out to be surprisingly hackable.
Last week, we talked about the so-called man-in-the-disk attacks. Again, maybe it was last week or the week before. Anyway, in the last couple of weeks, this was the vulnerability which had come to light where many apps were staging themselves in external storage, which many Android devices have. It's a shared resource. And it's that sharing of the resource that creates the problem, because many apps have overlapping access to that shared resource, creating the so-called man-in-the-disk attacks. So it turns out that the extremely popular first-person shooter, Leo? I've never looked at what it actually is. I just know it's
Battle Royale. You go in and 100 other people go in and last man standing wins. Yeah,
it's okay.
kind of a first-person shooter, special kind.
So Google takes a 30% cut of all revenue generated by apps downloaded through the Google Play Store. And as you have often observed on the Twit Network, Leo, I've heard you talking about Fortnite. Actually, it's about Fortnite itself is free, but they make money, like a ton of money.
Yeah.
Selling other stuff in the game.
Yeah.
So over on iOS, with where Fortnite has a player base of, it's estimated between 125 and 150 million users. I think that's maybe across both platforms. During the first 10 days of season 5, the iOS release netted Epic Games, the publisher of Fortnite, $2 million per day. $2 million per day. So the total mobile revenue on iOS between its March 15th release and the end of July was $150 million. Since there's no other method of distributing apps in the Apple ecosystem other than the Apple Store, Epic Games had no choice but to hand over a piece of their action to Apple. But not so on Android. Epic Games has elected to bypass Google and the Play Store and to teach how to and encourage people, because there's no other way to obtain this latest Fortnite, how to sideload Fortnite by downloading an APK from Fortnite's own website. So this, of course, requires instructing people to push past all the side-loading warnings present on Android devices. And the big worry among the security community is that this could have the effect of encouraging and normalizing the side-loading process and behavior and pave the way to additional Fortnite clone malware. And, of course, we've previously talked about how there were Fortnite cheat add-ons that have been malicious and have hurt people. So it turns out that on top of this, that is that Fortnite has decided to sideload in order to not give Google a piece of their substantial action on the Android platform, because it's possible, Fortnite is one of the apps vulnerable to this man-in-the-disk attack that we've been talking about, which the researchers at Checkpoint recently made clear. Google may be being a little miffed at Fortnite for encouraging sideloading, did not give Epic a 90-day window to fix after it came to light that the Fortnite installer was vulnerable to hijacking through man-in-the-disk attacks. In Google's posting, they wrote, "The Fortnite APK, which is com.epicgames.fortnite, is downloaded by the Fortnite installer to external storage." And then in the show notes, I just clipped out a chunk of directory listing showing all of the entries there. And then Google continues saying, "Any app with the right external storage permission can substitute the APK immediately after the download is completed and the fingerprint is verified." Google writes, "This is easily done using a file observer. The Fortnite installer will proceed to install the substituted fake APK. On Samsung devices, the Fortnite installer performs the APK install silently via a private Galaxy Apps API. This API checks that the APK being installed has the package name com.epicgames.fortnite, but does nothing else. Consequently, the fake APK with a matching package name can be silently installed. If the fake APK has a target SDK version of 22 or lower, it will be granted," that is, this potentially malicious fake APK "will be granted all permissions it requests at install time. This vulnerability allows an app on the device to hijack the Fortnite installer to instead install a fake APK with any permissions that would normally require user disclosure." Okay, so in response, unhappily, Epic released version 2.1. And as I said, Epic is clearly unhappy with Google's short notice. They said actually it was Tim Sweeney at Epic who tweeted, "We asked Google to hold the disclosure until the update was more widely installed."
You can see why that's not going to happen, though.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Because it's out there. It's happening.
Exactly. Tim said Google refused creating an unnecessary risk for Android users in order to score cheap PR points, is what Tim at Epic tweeted.
Really?
Google defended their timing, saying that their own instrumentation had shown that most Fortnite users had already updated to version 2.1. So anyway, much has been made of this, and a lot of coverage in the press has been unhappy with Epic's decision. I mean, it's difficult to be when you consider the amount of money that Epic is talking about. On the other hand, they're only making the money because Google has created the platform.
And I think you're risking your customers' safety to make some more money. And now, was there already an exploit in the wild? I mean, it seems to me that the reason Google had to go public, well, I don't know. I mean, is to tell people to stop sideloading. Or maybe there were no exploits going on?
Well, this doesn't prevent sideloading. It was that Fortnite's loader.
No, I understand, reason they exposed it is because people were actively at risk right now, right?
Yes, exactly. Yes.
But I mean, were there people taking advantage? My sense was that it had already happened, that there were some.
It was essentially a zero day.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you got to tell people. So they stop doing it until it's fixed.
Yes. 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 Okay. And immediately get the word out.
I mean, imagine if Google didn't tell anybody and people were getting infected right and left. Oh, well, we wanted responsible disclosure so that Epic could fix it. Well, that's not responsible. That's irresponsible, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Epic's just cheesed because they did the wrong thing and they got bit.
Well, and, you know, as we talked about when we were talking about this whole man of the disc problem, Google does clearly state that, for example, apps should do what Epic 2.1 now does. Now does. But they've always said this, you know, that if you're going to use external storage, make very sure that you're actually installing the APK or whatever it is, you know, like that you can trust what it is that is in that store. And Epic just wasn't. No. They were like, download some more Fortnite stuff and let's just suck it right in. And, you know, this really did open them to the hack. And, of course, the security community is upset because the problem is this, you know, sideloading is dangerous because you are training people to push past all of the warnings that Google has saying, we haven't been able to check this. We don't know what this is you're loading. You need to be really sure. And here Epic is widely distributing to tens of millions, if not more, users their app. Not only was it insecure, but they're encouraging the circumvention of the Google Play Store. So be interesting to see how this plays out. Mm. Sonar Scoop.
Snoop. Snoop.
Snoop. Yeah. You and I both did that.
No, yes. I totally did it before the show. And I was, what is a Sooner? I think it corrected to Sooner Scoop, which for the Sooners, it was a sports site. And I was like, for the Oklahoma Sooners football team. And I was like, this is not right.
So I tell you, this is the best time of year for the podcast because we've got the Usenix conference and we've got Black Hat and DEF CON. I mean, it is just security conference heaven. So this is another piece of research that was shown at the 3 weeks ago now Baltimore Usenix security conference. In the show notes, I have a picture from their research PDF, which they published as part of the conference proceedings. It shows the back of a Samsung Galaxy S4 with the microphone that you would with the microphone at the top of the phone and the speaker on the back. Oh, I'm sorry. The microphone at the bottom that you normally talk to and a speaker at the bottom. And then on the other picture is a top located microphone and a top located speaker. So the top one is where your ear normally is. And you, obviously the bottom microphone is where your mouth normally is. But to increase noise cancellation, and the utility of the phone, they put both the microphone and a speaker also on the opposite ends. So you've got a top microphone, a top speaker, a bottom microphone, and a bottom speaker. Well, the next page of the show notes, I show their simplified diagram of what that means. That means you can ping from the top speaker a ultrasonic sound that the user will not hear, which will be received after some length of time based on how far away the person is, and the rate at which sound travels will be heard by the upper microphone. Similarly, you can ping from the bottom speaker and it will bounce off the underside of the user's finger and back into the bottom microphone. In other words, classic sonar. And now to triangulate, you really would want the sensors to be mounted on adjacent corners of the area. That way, if you get if you take the two distances, you know, so they're on, it's called triangulate because they're the two sensors lie on one edge of a triangle, and then the distance that they're each sensing informs it of the length of the other two lengths of the triangle, allowing it to uniquely determine the apex of the triangle not containing the sensors, thus triangulation. We don't have that here. We've got, you know, kind of arbitrarily located sensors. So it's less than ideal, but their research demonstrates that they are able to not perfectly, but to significantly determine the instantaneous position of a user's finger which is in contact with the screen. So reading from their abstract at the top of their research, they said, "We report the first active acoustic side channel attack. Speakers are used to emit human inaudible acoustic signals, you know, like bats, and the echo is recorded via microphones, turning the acoustic system into a smartphone sonar system. The echo signal can be used to profile user interaction with the device. For example, a victim's finger movements can be inferred to steal Android unlock patterns. In our empirical study, the number of candidate unlock patterns that an attacker must try to authenticate herself to a Samsung S4 phone can be reduced by up to 70% using this novel acoustic side channel." So note, not reduced to zero, but, you know, it's reduced by more than half. "The attack is entirely unnoticeable to victims. Our approach," they write, "can be easily applied to other application scenarios and device types. Overall, our work highlights a new family of security threats." So in terms of details, they used a dictionary of 12 unlock patterns. Okay, so not the universe of possible unlock patterns. They just, you know, they were looking for, does this kind of work at all? So they used a dictionary of 12 unlock patterns in their tests, which contained 15 unique strokes. The data collected from 12 volunteers was fed into an AI learning machine model for classification of each stroke. And as expected, the classification accuracy was significantly higher when simultaneous input from both microphones was considered. The researchers reduced the average number of correct candidates from the 12 unlock patterns to 3.6. That's average. In some instances, the analysis eliminated all guesses and revealed the single correct pattern uniquely. I looked at the research, and I won't go into any more detail here because everybody gets it. But I have a strong gut sense that we're going to see this evolve. It uses sensors available in our devices. It could certainly be used for benign purpose, like, you know, moving your hand around in front of an app in order to do something and having the app respond. It's not super high fidelity. Again, the sensors are not located exactly where you want them. Was it the Apple? Well, I mean, it was the Amazon phone. They had like some funky sensor in each corner of the screen for a while, didn't they, Jason?
And that was meant to kind of change the parallax of what you were looking at. It was meant to kind of like, I don't know, from the four points, be able to determine your perspective and shift accordingly.
So to see your face so that they could change the screen in order to make it look more depthy.
It was a lot of hardware for a very minimal application purpose.
Yeah.
But no, what this reminds me of is, if you remember, I think it was like 3 or 4 years ago at Google I.O., Google had shown off something called Project Soli, which was also...
Yes. And I am so jazzed by that, where you like, you do like, you know, like push buttons and turn knobs and things. Oh, yep. I really want to see that happen. I
haven't really heard much about it since then. And I think their idea was that it would possibly be integrated into like wearables, like smartwatches of some sort, so that you wouldn't have to touch it, but you could still do the controls. And then there's also something else that I read about called, what was it? It was called Finger IO, which there's a demonstration. Yes. And that seems a little bit more in line with what Sonar Snoop is all about.
Yeah, and Soli was EM radiation, so it was very low level electromagnetic radiation that gave it extremely high resolution in return for having to have a lot of processing behind it. But anyway, this is I thought this was very cool, very clever, something no one had thought of before, and I wouldn't be surprised if we see this evolving in the future. This feels like something that could be taken from this initial research out to its next level. So props to these guys and a nice piece of research.
Yeah.
No matter what you call it.
I'm curious on a device specific perspective, because like you were saying, you know, every phone has a microphone and a speaker in a different location.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, you know, for this to work on a broad spectrum of Android devices, like, I imagine those locations create different hurdles as far, or different requirements for where exactly on the screen your finger is at any given moment. If the speakers and microphones are over here versus over there, does that then narrow down, you know, the accuracy differently?
Well, and so, for example, one thing that's, if somebody wanted to be clever, they could create a game which you know inherently requires you to move your finger around and touch different areas of the screen.
Oh, to learn.
While you're playing the game, it's doing sonar on you and you don't know.
It's calibrating.
Yes.
Yep. Dang it. That's too wise. That's too smart. And you know what? That'll probably happen. But this only really, from a security standpoint, it seems like this really only works if you're doing like a swipe pattern, right? Would there be any indication that it would work with like tapping in a pin or something along those lines?
That's exactly what I mean when I say this feels like first gen.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they demonstrated the concept is viable. And so I wouldn't be surprised if before long they could turn this into read keystrokes on a keyboard.
Totally. Well, that's another thing that's kind of reminded me of the whole thread from years ago about people being able to listen to someone typing on a keyboard and being able to reconstruct what they're typing based on the sound of those keys clacking.
Yeah, that's just bizarre, but it's true.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, this stuff is crazy.
I think the thing that has received the least attention, but it is certainly significant, about this Facebook breach, when you hear 50 million accounts were compromised and another 40 like one level removed may also have been, you sort of think, oh, look, you know, like mass collection breach of some sort. You know, that's what we're used to. Like when a web service loses its database, it's, well, you know, how many of just like randomly chosen records out of total got loose. What's significant about this is that this particular breach was absolutely targetable by its nature. And in fact, Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg's accounts were both targeted and potentially compromised. So the point is that the people who discovered this had to do a lot of work. It's a sophisticated attack. So somebody was poking at Facebook for some period of time because Facebook is Facebook, and the ability to perform the attack occurred in July of 2017, right? So like 17 months ago. Quite a while ago. That's been there for all this time. The only way this account, the breach was discovered, was a side effect of the way it works is people apparently logging in. And essentially what you're able to do, and I'll explain a little bit, you know, what we know of how, you're able to cause an unauthenticated login of someone else in order to bring their login token current. And it was the sudden increase in the background continuous and certainly high level of that happening, but it suddenly spiked. And so the Facebook people said, you know, the engineers said, wait a minute, why are we suddenly seeing a dramatic increase in the rate of people logging in? And that's what tipped it off. But we don't know over what period of time this thing occurred. And the point is that it's completely stealthful unless someone notices that, like by looking at their own account, wait a minute, somebody logged in from somewhere else and left a breadcrumb behind, or something gets changed. Okay, so the crux of this is a feature that's sort of scary, but also certainly useful. I remember, it was when I was playing with trying to get a hold of and get a handle on the way Facebook's viewability stuff works. As I said, Leo, I do have a Facebook page. I don't use it. I don't think there's anything posted on there. But I created the account in order to see other people's. And also when I wanted to explore the Facebook privacy and security settings, because I've talked about them a couple times. And so certainly one of the things that is very useful, because in any environment where you want to curate who can see what, is you want to test that. You want to view your own page as if you were someone else. And well, that's impersonation. And it turns out that Facebook understood that this was dangerous. And so, but they also understood they needed to offer the feature. So you've always had this view as feature, which would allow you to cause Facebook to show your page as if you were someone else. And you get to specify whom. So if you said I want to see Mark Zuckerberg's view of my Facebook page, on some level, there's been the invocation of Mark Zuckerberg's identity into like viewing your Facebook page. So that was part of this. Is this the way ViewAs works? Then it turns out that there's a video tool, a video upload capability, which allows you to send somebody like a birthday greeting, upload a video. And it's that tool which acquired a bug in July of 2017, which caused it to incorrectly manage the identity tokens that it was having to juggle in the authentication of different people, such that the bad guys were able to in a multi-factor attack to leverage ViewAs and the mistake in this video upload tool in order to obtain a current logged in authentication token for, and here it is, anyone they want it, which is what makes this so scary, is this thing has been in place since July of 2017. We don't know that it hasn't been used, that it hasn't been known. Who knows how many mysterious breaches or people's pages being changed or mischief or what has been gotten up to during that time. Because, again, it wasn't, you know, Zuckerberg's was compromised, Sheryl's account was compromised. So clearly, before they began a much higher speed wholesale rifling, they were going after high profile targets, it seems. So that's now been closed. Facebook has, understanding the nature of the breach, is able to go back in their logs, see this being done. And then what happened on Friday was that 50 million people, actually 90 million people, suddenly found themselves logged out of Facebook. And it was like, you know, because then, and everyone's used to like Facebook leaving you persistently logged in because it's convenient. Well, and as we know, what that means is that you have a cookie in the form of an authentication token from Facebook, which your browser presents whenever it pulls any resource from Facebook, which authenticates you as being logged in as you on this browser. So those were all of those authentication tokens were immediately invalidated, and consequently people had to log in again. Now the reason, the sort of the other shoe here to drop, is that it's bad enough that a bad guy could obtain an authenticated session for anyone they wanted. Now, that's what this means. I mean, since July of 2017, if anybody who knew about this could obtain a valid logged-in session for anyone they wanted. But what that means by extension is that the now, unfortunately, very popular login with Facebook can be abused, because it means that your browser contains a valid Facebook login token for anybody you have targeted, which means when you log in with your Facebook account, you're logging in with their Facebook account, meaning that you're able to log into any other third-party service that where they have an account recognized by Facebook. So, for example, under single sign-on or of single sign-on, in Wired magazine's coverage of this, they said the debacle also underscores broader concerns about single sign-on, which Friday turned into the ultimate object lesson in the inherent trade-offs between security and convenience. Ken White, the director of the Open Crypto Audit Project, said, "Single sign-on schemes are great, but the downside is if a single sign-on gets breached, you're hosed." So Wired says sticking with a single, more secure sign-in does make sense, especially for use on sites that don't have the resources or inclination to invest heavily in security development. Actually, none of that's true, but because I mean that because, well, anyway, but just like you want your passwords to be unique, so compromising one doesn't expose them all, account diversity is also vital online, no matter how ironclad a particular sign-in scheme is. Then they said, quote, "You don't want a situation where there's one breach and your entire online identity is gone," says the same guy, Ken White. So anyway, that's what happened. It was longstanding. It was, I mean, and again, this is, it's hard to do what Facebook is doing at the scale they're doing it. I would argue that view as is necessary and terrifying. I mean, it is inherently a horrifying from a implementer's, you know, security standpoint. I mean, it is a real pucker factor because, boy, you know, you really got to get it right. And it looks like largely they did, but in one place they missed something and someone found a little way to wedge themselves in and leverage something which is, I mean, and Facebook obviously is, as we all know, is really staggering at the moment under all, I mean, like, you know, you've deleted your you just said it, Leo, you've deleted your Facebook account. I mean, they've been staggering under all kinds of privacy issues as a consequence of being, you know, what is it, 2 billion users?
2.5, and being, yeah,
so,
yeah.
Being so popular. So, right. I would argue against Zuckerberg, who said, he called it a arms race. It's like, no, I mean, it's hard to get it right. I absolutely agree. And here I empathize with them that, you know, if you're going to have the ability to show different classes of users different views of your content, then you need to be able to audit that, which means you need to be able to say, what would so-and-so see of my page? And it's like, yeah. Okay, you know, scary. But it is actually a perfect example of, I mean, I already hate OAuth. I consider it a horrific kludge because as we know and we've talked about, users don't understand that when you log in with Google or log in with Facebook or log in with Twitter or whatever, the reason those services are happy to provide this referral service is they're tracking you. They're knowing everywhere you're logging in and adding it to their compilation of your profile, and you're giving, you know, you're updating your information about them. And as we've just now seen, if that service suffers a breach anywhere you have used them, you're now subject to, you know, I mean, they've extended the blast radius beyond their own perimeter to everywhere else. So anyway, it's one of the reasons why when I first told us all about Squirrel years ago, I said it's a two-party solution. It's secure single factor. You know, it's like the only reason you need multi-factor is none of them are secure enough. So you need lots of them in order to increase the security. If you have secure one factor, then it's all you need. And the beauty of it is it's just two party. The problem with this login as is you're bringing in a third party, which, and here's an example of it going wrong. So Anyway, that's what happened with Facebook. And again, I don't think I'm not saying, oh, this is a glaring problem. I mean, I would argue that the reason they're already in hot water, those are clearly that has been Facebook's policy problems that have come home to roost. Here, this was a really obscure bug, and anybody can make a mistake. You know, they did get it fixed quickly. And to our listeners, I would say, take this opportunity to go use the Facebook tool, which they provide, of where have logins to your account occurred, from which devices and from which locations. Just make sure you recognize them all, because that's worth doing. And also, you know, eliminate any applications that you've given permission to use your Facebook account that you're no longer using. As we've said, that kind of periodic audit can be a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe this is just a wake-up call. Is there a safe way to use single sign-on solutions like that, OAuth solutions?
The problem is users are not given enough control.
Right.
There ought to be a way to revoke the otherwise persistent relationship that is connect of the connection between the authentication token that you give the third party and the site you're visiting. Facebook did also kill all of those referral tokens, essentially, which was good. But the problem is it's done behind the scenes, and it's meant to make the system easy to use. But because users are not given visibility into it, it's not something that's easy to do. It's better just not to have it in the first place. Yeah.
Used to be you could do your own OAuth, I remember. You could have your own site, but I don't know how that would work if a site didn't know about it.
Yeah, remember you were able to put a token on a page on your server.
Yeah.
and bounce you through.
That would be so much better. I guess it wouldn't help the average Joe, but
yeah.
That's the problem.
The average Joe is going to have a solution here pretty soon.
It's called Squirrel.
Whee!
Squirrel.
Did Google hide a quote major unquote Google Plus security flaw that exposed users' personal information? The headlines about this were breathless.
Yeah.
Google hid major Google Plus security flaw that exposed users' personal information. Google Plus shutting down after bug leaks info of 500,000 accounts. Google to shut down Google Plus after failing to disclose user data breach. Google is shutting down Google Plus after a secret potential data leak. Google Plus to shut down after cover up of data exposing bug. Okay, so what happened? Given what Google's own security research auditors found, which is who found this back in March, and given all of the deliberately privacy-constrained information Google had at their disposal, which is not much because they were deleting it on purpose to protect users, I think they've acted responsibly and appropriately. The controversy here is that the Wall Street Journal caught wind of this discovery of theirs back in March, which Google fixed because they're and didn't say anything about at the time, because Google, despite looking for any evidence that anybody else knew of this bug, was unable to find it. Since their logs were incomplete, they couldn't be absolutely sure it had never been used, but they had no reason to believe it had been. So yesterday, the VP of engineering posted under Project Strobe, says that the posting is protecting your data, improving our third-party APIs, and sunsetting consumer Google Plus. And of course, we've talked about Google Plus. I know you guys
love it. Yeah,
yeah, but you know, kind of just was one of those things that never got off the ground.
No. It was there, you know, they really put all their all the wood behind the arrows there. They even gave people bonuses 1 year based on Google's social success. Because they were trying to stop Facebook, but it didn't take off. Yeah. And then once it was neglected, as any social network does, it became spam and porno.
Yep, yep. And very much like MySpace, which is just like kind of like okay. So from their announcement, I pulled a few relevant bits. So they wrote, at the beginning of this year, we started an effort called Project Strobe, a root and branch. And I'm thinking, what? Is that like soup to nuts? I guess so. But that's a root and branch.
A corporate term of art. That's
what that review of third-party developer access to Google account and Android device data, and of our philosophy around apps data access. So that's all good. This project, they wrote, looked at the operation of our privacy controls, platforms where users were not engaging with our APIs because of concerns around data privacy, areas where developers may have been granted overly broad access, and other areas in which our policies should be tightened. So, like, you know, a very what we want from Google focused, self-imposed audit of their stuff. So they say, they continue, our review showed that our Google Plus APIs and the associated controls for consumers are challenging to develop and maintain. I didn't dig in enough to know what that means. That sounds like, you know, corporate speak for we didn't do it right, or it's hard to do it right. I don't know.
APIs anyway, are hard.
Yeah. Tell me. Anyway, underlying this, as part of our Project Strobe audit, we discovered a bug in one of the Google Plus People APIs. Okay, so now here's what we know. They wrote, users can grant access to their profile data and the public profile information of their friends to Google Plus apps via the API. The bug meant that apps also had access to profile fields that were shared with the user but not marked public. So these were meant to be kept private. So they were user-provided fields that the user was not meant, that did not intend to share publicly.
So I'll give you an example of what those are, because as soon as this came out, I went to my Google Plus profile, which I set up ages ago. And there's mostly public stuff, your links, your stuff. And there were two things in there that were private. One was my personal phone number, and one was my address. I have no idea why I put my personal phone number and address in there, because they weren't publicly viewable. But maybe there was something. I think
may have been for account recovery at the time.
Could be, or there were layers of sharing. I think there were. I can't remember. So, worst case, I mean, nobody's putting a credit card number in there.
Yes, and actually you can't.
Right.
Google explains this data is limited to static, optional Google Plus profile fields, and they said including name, email address, occupation, gender, and age. Then in their posting they gave a full link. And it is worth noting that there is some additional stuff that's a little more worrisome. The full list contains a lot more. There is birthday, profile photo, relationship status, current and previous employers with dates, places previously lived, and skill sets.
Yeah, I don't know why you put those in if they're super secret. I'm not sure. Maybe there was some incentive to do that, but.
So Google says it does not include any other data you may have posted or connected to Google Plus or any other service like Google Plus posts, messages, Google account data, phone numbers. Well, except in your case.
I put them in. I had one public number and one private number in there.
Right. Or G Suite content. Then they say, we discovered and immediately patched this bug in March of 2018. We believe it occurred after launch, and I should mention that's 2015, so it had been present for years, as a result of the API's interaction with a subsequent Google Plus code change. They said, we made Google Plus with privacy in mind, and therefore keep this API's log data for only 2 weeks, which in this case turns out to have been a double-edged sword. They say that means we cannot confirm which users may have been impacted by this bug. However, we ran a detailed analysis over the 2 weeks prior to patching the bug, meaning they had those 2 weeks of previous log data. And from that analysis, the profiles of up to 500,000 Google Plus accounts were potentially affected. And that's a key word. Our analysis showed that up to 438 applications may have used this, the so-called People API. And then they conclude, we found no evidence that any developer was aware of this bug or abusing the API. And we found no evidence that any profile data was misused. So, I think they have behaved responsibly. Unfortunately, look what happens when an uncritical reading of the details gets loose. And so, given that, and apparently the Wall Street Journal reported that they got a hold of internal memoranda which suggested that Google was concerned that Sundar would be yanked in front of a congressional committee a la Facebook and the abuse of Facebook's private information and all kind of lumped into one mess if back in March they had said we found a bug that we have no evidence was misused, but it could have been, and it could have affected up to 500,000 Google Plus users' private data. Again, an uncritical understanding of this even now led to those headlines. So I think Google did the right thing. It would be nice to have had all of the logs of that, but then that could have been a problem. I mean, like even a potentially bigger problem. So, I don't think, as I said, it's a double-edged sword. I come down on the side of thinking that Google, given the situation, did the right thing. We're unable to stop talking about, for better or for worse, the Windows 10 October 2018 update. The infamous build 1809 has another problem. So as we know, the good news is it's still not re-released yet. So they found this in some preview build 18.234, also known as 19H1. I've not been tracking all this cryptic
19H1 is the next one.
Okay.
So this is 18.09 is the one that was supposed to come out now, September 2018. Now you're talking about 19.03, basically, which is 19H1, the first half of 2019. So that's an insider. That's in the insiders are getting this now.
Okay.
There's something wrong with the process at Microsoft. This is actually getting to be problematic. I mean, seriously.
And Leo, we're looking for that in that new era of enhanced productivity. Was that what they were advertising?
That's something in the most secure version of Windows ever.
That's right. I love that. We remember.
I've seen a number of articles recently saying the problem really is the way Microsoft does this, which is they've got a code base. They do these short, like 6-week sprints to add a feature. So they spend a long time thinking of the features. They, in 6 to 8 weeks, they create the feature. There's no testing at that point. They lay it into a testing version, which they then test for a long period of time. This is how they did it when they did three-year releases, but they're still doing this now for these biannual releases. And it's not an effective testing process. They need a better way of testing before they get them into these beta releases. That may be. There may be a structural problem here. We'll talk about it tomorrow on Windows Weekly, I'm sure.
So, as we know, when the content, those of us who are power Windows users and who understand zip files, when the content of a zip file extraction would cause the overwrite of an existing same named file within the archive, the user, I know, Leo, are you sitting down? The user should be prompted about the pending overwrite.
Yeah.
That's right, a file naming collision, and asked whether to replace or skip the extraction of the colliding file. It turns out that build 1809 is reportedly and reproducibly either overwriting existing zip file content without notification or silently failing and doing nothing. So the good news is this problem has been caught before. What I wrote, now I'm not sure. It's been caught before the full formal re-release of build 1809, but it was reported as being in 1809. I assumed it was the pre-release people.
Yeah. Yeah.
A recent tweet by an IT staff engineer at Microsoft on the Windows Insider program team indicated that this problem has been resolved back on October 6th with the Windows Insider preview build 18.2.34, which is 19H1.
Huh.
So
that means they fix it for the next generation.
Yeah, well, they clearly have to fix it now.
They need to fix it for both.
And I know that this is just – I'm kicking this dead horse one last time. But in some recent reporting over on Computer World, I noted that Microsoft's forensic analysis revealed that as many as 1,500 instances of build 1809's pre-release testers – had their files deleted and complained without Microsoft noticing.
Microsoft said it was 1%, 1/100 of 1%.
Yeah.
What did you just say? What percentage?
1,500 by number.
Oh, okay. 1,500. That might fit. That might fit. Because remember, a lot of people try these builds. You know, this is a
they
public
did.
Build.
They did, and but a lot got bit, and Microsoft said,
a lot
oh,
of people.
We missed that one.
A lot of people with bad data.
Also, I should just note that after talking about this for the last few podcasts, in between then and now, I updated the machine I'm talking to you on, Leo. This camera that I'm looking at is running Windows 10. It was running Windows 10 Home, which is what came pre-installed on the little Windows 10 box that I just grabbed, just a little turnkey box. Anyway, it's now running Pro because I'm an MSDN subscriber, so it doesn't cost me anything to update. So I updated to Pro since I definitely decided that I want to begin hanging back from each month's security updates as well as the biannual feature, unquote, update.
Right.
You know, there's nothing I need that much each month that's worth being bit like this. And, you know, I'd rather let them, you know, I think that the security release, we would know within a week if it was causing problems. So, you know, I've set that to, you know, give me 2 weeks. And I think I set it to 30 days for the feature update because we would know by then if it's something – if you really should put it off further. So, again, and as I mentioned, Windows 10 Home does not give you the option to delay – to defer these. You take them when they make them available. I hope that our listeners consider after, you know, this painful October – this set of October surprises, consider deferring as I now have enough. I mean, so much so that I switched to the Pro version just so that I, you know, I could have that feature. It just seems wrong that Microsoft is, you know, being stingy about that. No, we're going to make you have Pro if you want to, you know, defer. It's like, my God, okay.
Oh, Windows 1809, the gift that just keeps on giving. I think they finally did ship 1809. They solved all the problems. But, of course, guess what? Microsoft's going to be right back at the table in the spring. They're currently calling it, 2019 1H. I suppose at some point it'll transmogrify into a 1903. Those are those date-based code names. We've talked a lot about that on this show. We've talked a lot about it on Windows Weekly. And just cross your fingers. The 2019 doesn't bring more Windows flaws. I hope you've enjoyed Security Now. I think it's probably the most important show we do, certainly for those of you who are security professionals or just regular users trying to keep yourself safe online. We really appreciate everything Steve does. I want to thank Karsten Bondi for putting all of this together. He found all the best of clips and our editors. Who edited this one? Is it, do you know? Colleen might know. Anyway, thank you to our editors for putting these together. They work hard so that they can take a little time off and be with their families. I hope you're with your family on this holiday season. And I'm glad that you consider us part of your holiday family. Thanks for watching all this time. 13 years of Security Now. And well, here's to 13 more. Steve says it's going to continue until episode 999. Maybe we can work on it and get him to go into four digits. Happy holidays, everybody. Happy New Year. Here's to a safe and peaceful 2019. And we'll see you on January 8th. Bye-bye. Security Now.